Hello, I'm Jack.
And I'm Martin.
And we are The Washboard Resonators. Welcome to our podcast, The Washboard Resonators Present. Conversations from behind the red curtain on vintage music and stories from the entertainment industry.
Okay then, so welcome to this week's The Washboard Resonators Present. Now, Jack, today we've got somebody who's very special. He's kind of your contributor. Tell us about Rusty.
Yeah, so this is Mark Jess of Rusty Drums, who I've wanted to get on this podcast for a little while because I've known him a few years and I wanted to know how he kind of runs his business and about, I didn't know anything about his playing career either. So I just wanted to see how he started playing and background in that and then how he started his business, and because it's one of the best drum places around, you know, one of those places you can go into one really nice space, see all the quality stuff under one roof, and he's a very personable person.
Okay, excellent. Well, I can't wait to find out more about this guy, one of the leading vintage drum dealers in Britain.
Yeah, even you like going to that shop as a non-drummer.
I love it. I don't even play drums or know anything about them, but I love it.
There you go. Let's go into it. Right, Mark, welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for doing this.
Absolute pleasure.
I've known you for quite a few years and I've bought a few drum kits and single drums off of you, and we always come to your amazing shop and admire what you've got. But I don't know much about your backstory, and I would like to know how you kind of started playing and your playing career, and then how you got into running the great business you do, Rusty Drums, down in Luton. We always ask people at the start of this, so do you mind saying where you live and when you were born, if you want?
Born in 1981, and I live in sunny Bedfordshire, centre of the musical universe. Yeah, I've been born in the L&D hospital, so yeah, mentioned Luton, that's as close as I get to Luton, but yeah, lived out in Barton le Clay since I was three.
Oh, okay, right, oh, I didn't realise that. So is this where you grew up around here? Were you from a musical family at all?
Dad played a little bit guitar. He had a 12-string that he used to strum and torture us with every now and then. Mum, bless her, she always said you could never carry a tune in a paper bag, so very unmusical. But my brother started playing. He went to middle school, because we have a three-tier system over here, and he started tuba lessons.
Okay.
And joined the local Toddington Town band and came back one day and asked whether I'd like to go along and play drums, because they were desperately in need of a drummer.
No, you're not talented enough for tuba. You need a,
that's it, yeah.
a drum someone can hit. Oh, so marching snare drum then? Or was it...
Started out with a crash cymbal and one stick, and the conductor would point at me like that to get ready and then do that every time he wanted me to hit the cymbal.
How old were you then?
Last year, about 8 years old, I think, just before I started having proper lessons.
Amazing.
And I was the most unconfident. I just wouldn't, you know, people would come to the front door and I'd hide. I wasn't a confident kid at all. And Mum said, you can ask him, but he'll never do it. And I went along and did it. And it just kept growing from there. So, you know, the first couple of weeks, it was the cymbal. Then there was a snare drum added. Then there was a bass drum added. Then he showed me a couple of, the conductor was a bit of a frustrated drummer himself. So he showed me a few patterns and started some lessons on reading music and crotchets and quavers and all that sort of jazz. And then by the time I hit middle school, there were lessons available, and just the rest is a very dodgy history.
Oh, so he's really a big help to your musical start, really, then, this conductor that you happen to.
Definitely, yeah.
Do you feel like you were drawn to the drums particularly at all, or was it just your brother was in that band and you wanted to fill in and that's what you were told to do, really?
I think that's how it started. It was just a case of, well, there's a chance to do it. Do you want to have a go? And then fell in love with it from there.
And did you find your confidence grew then after doing that? Was that a key to you?
Definitely, yeah. Yeah, suddenly you're the guy at the back, and in a brass band, if you make a mistake, everyone notices it, don't they?
Yeah.
So your confidence builds, and especially, you know, you start off with just a cymbal. There's a little fat lad standing at the back with a cymbal and a stick, and everyone looks if you do it wrong, or everyone looks if you do it right. You've got no way of escaping anything.
I found that that was a big learning curve for me, because I started playing in brass bands and things in Wales. We had a really good, and I talked about this before, we had a really good music service. And I started out playing trumpet at 7 and I started playing drums at 10. But
yeah,
the thing that really changed my mind was, can you imagine like the shitty kind of you start out bands where there's just two trumpet parts and there's 30 trumpet players playing part one and playing part two. So you're really in tune. You're playing like Men of Harlech or something, like a really beautiful tune. And then, but you're all in like a unit. So if I missed a note or I played it wrong, no one noticed. But then one day the drummer didn't turn up and I was about 11 or something. I've been playing like a year. And then I was put on drums. I didn't really think about it. They just said, because my trumpet teacher was there, he knew I played drums, so put me on. And I wasn't nervous, just played it. And then I realised that I had to get it right. When I got it wrong, it was like, as you said, everyone noticed. So like,
yeah.
In some way, I think my confidence was worse at the beginning, but then I feel like I rose to it because then you had to be right. And I learned quite quickly as well that people think drums are easy. Like you had said, oh, you know, we need a drummer. Just this 8-year-old that's never doesn't play any instruments. I'm sure he can play drums, which you know is not the way it goes. I learned very quickly that you have to. I kind of trick myself into being confident as long as I'm getting it right because your sound changes. Like with every instrument, if you're suddenly like playing, like, oh, I'm gonna get it wrong, and you play really timidly, drums sound different. You know,
definitely, yeah.
Okay, so you started having lessons then. You said.
Yeah, started through a similar sort of thing, an amazing music service down here. So lessons in school and suddenly, you know, you start to develop these patterns and you go back to the rehearsal on a Tuesday with a town band and you can play a basic eighth note rock groove and suddenly, like Men of Harlech suddenly got a groove over the top of it and everything you can play it in, they get you to do it because it sounds cool and it sounds different.
Exactly.
And it just built from there, really.
And you had a good teacher?
Yeah, I would say so. Yeah, definitely. Molded me, notation reading, that side of things, and that's again with the brass band thing as well. You suddenly you've got a bass drum part and a snare drum part for a march and you're sitting at the kit trying to read them both at the same time, and that's definitely, I'd always count myself as a good reader when it came to that side of things, and that all comes from that brass band background, I think.
Yes, yeah, definitely. So when did you start having lessons? In early secondary school?
So we have the three-tier system down here. So we have lower, middle and upper school. So I started probably at the beginning of year five. So okay. I was 9 years old when I started having proper drum lessons and you know, going through structured pieces and grade pieces and stuff like that.
And did you kind of think basically straight away, is that, you know, I might want to do this as a career or not sure yet? Or like...
No, still at that point, I think, you know, I wanted to follow in my dad's footsteps as a bank manager and love maths at that point and that side of things. And I just, I enjoyed playing and I enjoyed doing it. I've never been one to love the practice side of things. Mm. So, you know, the stuff that you were given in the lessons and doing the grade pieces didn't hold as much fun and enjoyment as going to the brass band and rattling around and discovering your own things. And I had that kind of both sides of it. I had a very structured lesson with the teacher in school and then I had this frustrated conductor drummer who wanted me to just go crazy and add stuff, and suddenly there were two bar solos added to pieces and,
oh great,
you know, big fills and things like that. So he pushed more on that side of things, a more creative side of things.
Did you want to or get a chance to kind of join a pop band or a rock band, you know, or did that come later?
That was quite a bit later, because through, you know, typical thing, you know, sort of year seven, year eight at school, and then they start a band and there's a lad that plays guitar and he learns how to play Unchained Melody. So you go to his house on a Wednesday night with your drum kit and play the same song 42 times.
And what was your first kit?
So when I first started, I was borrowing the school's old Premier kit. The middle school had an old Premier, and it would have been, you know, looking back now, it would have been a 3-ply shell with reinforcing rings, some old Premier Royale or something like that. But my first kit that my parents bought me belonged to the grandson of George Chisholm, you know, the famous jazz trombonist.
No, I don't actually, right.
That's George Chisholm. He was based around this. He lived in Barton-le-Clay. He lived out his final years around this way. And his grandson was same age as my brother, so 5 years older and at the upper school, and got this old Tama Imperial Star kit that I think had been rewrapped in contact paper and all that sort of stuff. And it was, you know, lugs falling off and stuff like that. But for, I think, 50 quid, we bought the kit. And I think my ninth birthday, mum and dad buying me a snare drum.
Yeah.
Bought me an old Premier steel snare drum in the stand. And, you know, used to sit and rattle around on that at home after I'd had me a bit of wood with a bit of carpet nailed on it as a practice pad before that.
It's funny you say that, because like I didn't have that. My dad was a bit of a drummer before, not really, but like he had a snare drum when he was younger, same. And like that thing used to be the old tradition that you got a snare drum first and you played that for a couple of years, a year or two, and then you got a drum kit, was it? Whereas
yeah.
I don't think that's not the way anymore. Do you find people ever buy? I guess you don't deal in like early drums, do you? So like people
no, but see, when I used to work in a drum shop, that was the thing. You could you know, and we spent 80 quid on a snare drum and a stand secondhand.
Yeah.
You go into you know, you can pick up a secondhand drum kit for a couple of hundred quid now.
Yeah, exactly. So it's
and I think teaching styles have changed. I'm very much, because I still teach 3 days a week, and I'm very much, you know, you teach kids singles and doubles and how to get around the kit in the first couple of lessons, like just doing that, and then they want to learn how to play grooves. Mm. So you're straight into rock beats. So the first, you know, they're not sitting practicing etudes and studies on the snare drum, they're straight into playing drum kit. So I think that's that mentality has changed for everyone along the line.
Yeah, and I guess that's got its positives and negatives, because like some of the great, I guess, I don't know about, I guess I'm talking about jazz drummers, but I don't know, like older, maybe some rock drummers as well, that started, well, definitely some rock drummers, but start on a snare drum or on a pad or something and then really get their hands together and then go.
Well, like the, you know, the big American guys, even the big rock and metal guys now, they all started in marching bands, didn't they? Exactly. They all got their chops together, they all got their hands together first. And whereas there isn't that mentality over here, I don't think.
No, which in one way is a shame it's lost, but another way, like how many. I think maybe getting on a drum kit, being able to play a couple of grooves and a couple of fills gets you into a band, and it's more inclusive and a lot more fun, perhaps less of a study and more of a joy, I guess. And is
that's it, yeah. If in lesson two or three with a kid, they're learning to play along with, even if it's something like We Will Rock You, that's something to grasp on. That's something very tangible for them.
Yes.
Whereas back in when I was learning, it was very much learn this study, learn this duet, learn this etude, you know, learn these pieces, learn how to play a roll and a parallel just on the snare drum.
But then I think some, I'd probably argue that doing that sort of thing is a better base, perhaps. If it's hard, you don't know how far you're going to take stuff, are you? Because if you're
not
everyone that starts drums wants to be a professional drummer at the highest level, you know, so they don't need to play flams and an etude very well at 12 or whatever, you know.
And I've got guys that come to me that can play, you know, play songs, play grooves, can't play a roll.
Yeah.
And you look back and you go, well, okay, yeah, there's a different grounding, there's a different basis to what you're doing.
Yes, definitely. Okay, did you go to uni or anything, or college? Or
I did. I went to music college. I did A-level music. So by the age of sort of 13, 14, I decided that it was definitely more music that I wanted to do. When I got to upper school, like, you know, surrounded by all these older musicians doing stuff, bands happening, I started orchestral percussion lessons. Okay. And very quickly did my grade 8 orchestral percussion. So, you know, learnt to play timps, learnt to play tunes.
Oh, amazing. Okay.
So got a grounding in that side of things as well, which, you know, you look at it now and people say about it, I don't think I could sit and play xylophone now without a lot of practice. Again, you very quickly get out of practice through these things.
Did you find when I did some studying of that, I struggled with some of the grip changes, because I was so used to doing classical snare drum and then drum kit, and they were quite I struggled with that, like an open timp roll, you know.
Suddenly playing French grip with your thumbs up and using your fingers and no bounce at all. It's a completely different discipline, but it was interesting to do. Definitely I think made me a more of an all-round player.
Yes, and really good, and great for reading, great for harmony, you know.
Yeah. I mean, from the age of 13 as well, I started piano lessons, because the idea of then going to music college and going to one of the serious conservatoires, you had to have a grounding in piano. And
yes.
And coming through the brass band thing again, I played euphonium as well. So, you know, you learned a melodic instrument as well.
Were your family kind of influence, like suggesting you doing these things as well? Or was this your own, like, decisions?
Partly because my brother was going to go off to, he went to the London College of Music as a tuba player, because he was that bit older than me. So we had 1 year crossover at upper school. So he was in upper sixth when I started in year 9. I could see the path that he was going and thinking, well, actually, that's something I really like the idea of as well. That's something I'd really fancy doing. And, you know, your priorities in life change, and suddenly you're playing in bands and you're doing all this stuff. And again, the County Music Service, we went through, and at the time we were going through it, there were four concert bands and five orchestras. And, you know, the top ones were grade 7 and 8 plus players.
So
really high standard of players. And to go through that, and we did courses there was a course in the summer, a course at Christmas, where you went for 4 or 5 days and you learnt the pieces and put a concert on at the end. We played at the Albert Hall. We did all sorts of stuff like that. So you got this kind of, suddenly got this, you dip your toe into big professional concert venues and rehearsals and things like that. And it fueled the passion to want to do it for a living, really.
Yeah, I can see that's a storm in the best way.
So, Mark, like at this point when you go to college, like who are your influences and heroes, and which kind of styles of music are you getting into, and which bands?
So, during high school, there was a guy called Ian Carfrae that played. I think he played with a band that had a Vegas residency and all sorts of stuff, an Oopoopy Doop band. And he kind of introduced us to Dixieland jazz, did a lot of big band stuff, and that's kind of where my passion was. I love doing that side of things.
Okay.
And so I auditioned and got a place at Trinity College of Music to do a foundation year and then go on do the degree. But then suddenly came into, you know, suddenly getting Oscar Peterson, Night Train and albums like that thrown at you. You've never heard that stuff because you've been big band swing and that side of jazz. And it was a complete eye opener on that side.
Sounds very, very jazz based then.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Yeah. That's where I flourished. That's what I enjoyed listening to and doing.
And is that still the case then, or have you kind of broadened since?
As much as I used to take the mickey out of my dear departed father for listening to country music, that's where my heart is now, listening to modern country stuff.
Never would have guessed that.
No.
Oh, wow.
If you catch me in the car listening to music, and it's one of these funny things that, like in the shop, the people don't believe that I don't have music playing in the shop, but I kind of like peace and quiet as well. Because I'm still teaching 3 days a week, because there's all this other stuff going around, and as you know, kids running around as well, just having some peace and quiet. But yeah, if you catch me, I'm listening to the Zac Brown Band, or I'm listening to Luke Combs or someone like that. It's that kind of music that I enjoy listening to now.
So do you go to Trinity?
Yeah, I did a foundation year, and then did the first 3 years of the 4-year degree and never finished it.
Whoa, what happened there then?
Lost the interest a little bit. Unfortunately, my dad got ill with cancer as well, so kind of priorities shifted a little bit there. But
yeah,
it was this weird thing that I'm going to London Music College. I'm going to live in London. So I got a place in a hostel in Notting Hill because there were no halls or anything like that, because Trinity was right in the middle of Mandeville Place, right off of Bond Street, you know, real central London kind of place. And I was one of 3 English people in the whole hostel, so I really kind of struggled with that, didn't enjoy that side of things. So then started commuting in instead. Then in my first year, they moved down to the Royal Naval College. So suddenly the commute's a 2.5-hour commute, and, you know, parts of the course that I didn't enjoy, there were bits that we did a bit on Sibelius and how to program Sibelius and do all that. That's fine, no problem. Then you get down there on a Wednesday and it's like clarinet, violin and drums, go and make jazz in a room. So this isn't really a course.
Yeah.
This is kind of, well, you get down there, oh, the lessons have been cancelled. I've just spent 20 quid on the train and 2 hours down here. Oh, there's a note in your pigeonhole. Well, that's great if you were living on, you know, in the area and you could nip in and check it out. But it just became a bit of a struggle and I'd lost interest, to be perfectly honest.
What was the course you're actually doing?
It was a B Muzz Honours in jazz music.
In jazz music, right?
Yes.
Jazz
so music. They'd started the course. The year that I did the foundation year, they actually started the degree course. So there was 1 year above me doing the course. And I think there was I won't talk badly about the college, but I think there was a bit of a making it up as you go along sort of situation and not quite sure what they were doing with it. The drummers that are on the course, out of 4 of us that started, only one finished.
Right.
That, you know, the 4-year course, because it wasn't geared at drummers, and we just kind of, we all struggled with it a little bit.
Yeah, I can see that from my my music college experiences. I've heard of pitfalls of other courses like that. What did you do next then?
So after I kind of disappeared off the Trinity course and said I wasn't going back, I had a year out where I tried to do as much playing as possible, but ended up managing a Masonic lodge bar, working as a night lobby in a little hotel in Barton as well.
Okay.
So kind of went into all sorts of, you know, gigging. Like by this time I was in a covers function band and doing lots of weekend gigs and that side of things. But during the week, doing these weird sort of evening jobs that I had time in the day to practice and to study and take things on myself. But then I got a place at ACM.
Okay.
To do the 2-year course. I was working part-time for the local education authority as a teacher.
Yeah,
I kind of did from the age of 18. So even when I was at college, I was doing a few private lessons and doing a couple of days teaching a week. And it was always a thing, oh, if you get a degree, then we'll pay you more because you're on, you know, on the basic salary. And the more effort you put into learning, the more we pay you. And so I decided that after not completing Trinity, I'd go and do the pop course, which, you know, It's one of those things. It used to turn up at Trinity, and if I was listening to anything with a backbeat, anything with an eighth note groove, you got frowned at because it was such a snobbery of jazz there. To then go and do a course where, you know, guys are there with long hair and flying V guitars and stuff like that. But that I found that was a really interesting course.
Yeah,
because they covered a bit of everything in there.
Yeah, I found generalizing is not true all around, but the pop course was in Leeds definitely was a lot more open.
Yeah.
Even though I didn't choose to do jazz, one, because I wouldn't have got in because my harmony isn't good enough. Same thing in Leeds, you had to have a certain level of piano harmony to get in, and they were a lot harder. Rightly or wrongly, I think that my experience of college was the jazz guys were pushed a lot harder than us pop students were. So you kind of had to motivate yourself more on the pop course, and then you could go wherever you wanted with it. And I think I did pretty well out of that course because I could attend the jazz lecture still, and I studied a lot of Latin percussion as well. And I still played in the orchestra and wind band because I'd done
right.
I didn't do as well as the classical students did there. They could play with better classical technique in the reading, but I could play clash cymbals, I could play a bass drum, I knew how to hit a gong, and you know, like the there's enough. So yeah, I think the pop courses were a bit more general all rounder, perhaps. So you found that at ACM?
I found that at ACM, yeah. I mean, again, it was one of those things that you think it was an 18-month course and you thought you were going to be there 5 days a week, 4 hours a day, and then suddenly it's 2 hours on a Tuesday and 3 hours on a Wednesday. So it was all kind of quite sporadic again. And
why did you choose to go back to studying? Is that just to help because you would have earned more money with teaching? Or why didn't you try and get lessons with a very well-established teacher or something? Or you didn't feel like you'd got to the level you wanted?
I think it was more to do with the whole thing of, you know, you should leave after spending this much time doing it. You should have a degree. You should have a bit of paper at the end of it, depending on where you want to go next. Because there was no, at this point, there was no thought of running a drum shop or doing any of that side of things. It was just, I want to be a player still. But if that doesn't work, I'm going to carry on with the teaching. And if I can earn £10 an hour more from having a piece of paper that says I actually studied something and got to the end of it.
Did you like the academic side of it as well?
I enjoyed the study. And, you know, all the way through, I think I was very lucky. I had some amazing teachers throughout Trinity. And, you know, ACM, we had lessons with Mike Sturgis and Pete Riley as well. So, you know, there's a great grounding of not necessarily going for hour and a half lessons with a very well-established session drummer, but having a taster with lots of different people.
Yes,
I had lessons at Trinity. I had Dave Wickens for the foundation year in the first year of degree, then Pete Zeldman as a teacher after that. I had a couple of lessons with Trevor Tompkins, and Mark Montesquieu was there. So there were some great drummers around.
Yeah, that's definitely a big advantage of music colleges, I think, and surrounded by all the other musicians, you know.
Yeah, having that saturation of education rather than going to one guy and doing the lessons that one guy's formulated that everyone does and comes out sounding the same at the end of it.
Mm, yeah. So, okay, so that's 4 years with the foundation at Trinity, 2 years at ACM. Yeah. So where's
the 2 years at ACM. So bizarrely, the second year at ACM, right at the beginning of it, I'd actually started working in a drum shop part-time at this point.
Where was that?
So it's a very strange thing that a lad, it's one of my best friends who was my original business partner with the Rusty Drums thing, he went to ACM. He decided to leave sixth form early because of, I think he was dyslexic and dyspraxic, wasn't really into the education side of things, and he went and did the diploma and higher diploma courses at ACM. So he went on the 1 year course
as well.
On drums as well. It's one of these funny things that he always said that I was his, you know, growing up through school I was his inspiration to become a drummer, and I'm damn sure he's a better drummer than I am now. He left sixth form after the first year, so sort of late 16 early 17 years old, went down to Guildford, got a place on the diploma course, which is much more practically based, was playing down there, going through the whole thing of, you know, image and marketing and that side of things, and did really well for himself, got some great originals gigs and stuff going on. And then after he'd done the higher foundation, his dad, who's a very clever doctor, said that he should go and get some sort of practical grounding and become a chippy or a sparky, or, you know, learn to do something with his hands.
Right.
So he'd been helping out in this local drum shop, and when he decided to go off and do what his next chapter in his life was, he asked me if I wanted to go and help this guy out. So I was working in a drum shop and doing bits and pieces in there. And at the start of the second year at ACM, I got a phone call from one of the customers who I knew really well, asking me if I wanted an ABBA tribute gig at Disneyland Paris.
Right.
So I disappeared off for what was supposed to be 5 weeks, ended up being just over 2.5 weeks, and ended up doing a little residency out there as like the first sort of real sort of pro gig. I've done functions and you know, played weddings and parties and stuff like that and got paid for it. But this was the first time it was out just doing an hour's gig a night and getting paid decent money for it away from home.
Yes, yeah.
Which is quite a fun experience.
So when was that then? Around 2006, 2007 or something?
Yeah, it would be.
So what happens next then in terms of like moving from that? Do you get a taste for more playing, or do you want to sort of practice more or get work on the degree? Or
I had a pretty horrible experience when I came back from that. I came back in the late October and my dad was rushed into hospital early November and died beginning of December. Right. So it was a bit of a, and it, this whole thing of going back and finishing off a degree, it kind of, it lost all interest. I remember going back in the January and seeing Mike Sturgis and said, "Are you okay?" I said, "Well, what's the point in all this at this point? You know, after what I've just been through in the last couple of months, I don't really." And I again, it's I suppose it might be me. It might be a pattern here. I lost interest in what I was doing. I was down there to finish the course, and I did everything I could to do it. But just got to that point where it's like, I'm done with this. I need to go out and earn money and look after mum. And
it puts things into perspective and it changes
massively. Yeah,
but yeah, that's. So you didn't, you never got your all important piece of paper, which has really held you back.
I have got it. I ended up with a 2-2 B Mus honours somewhere.
And it was really important, wasn't it, Mark? It's really affected your career, the fact you got that piece of paper.
You know what? I say this to students that I teach at the minute that stress about GCSEs, stress about A levels. I mean, I'd still have a reoccurring dream. I never finished my A level physics. I was 1% off a mark in A level physics and they left the course open for me. And every now and then I wake up in a cold sweat that I've had this dream that I never finished it and I didn't get to music college. So, and I've gone through and, you know, I teach in three schools and four for a little while there. I've never been asked for my qualification.
No.
So no one's ever asked me. And I still remember saying to a parent a little while ago, "Well, I've got a degree." And they're like, "Really? What in?" Yeah. As if it was such a surprise. "Well, I've got a performance degree in music." Mm. But, you know, you're paying me 15, 16 quid an hour, a half hour to teach your kid. And you didn't even ask or care about it because, do you know what? Practical experience and personality and everything else is much more important than that piece of paper.
Yeah, yeah.
Unless you're a local music education authority.
Yeah, I mean, you think people are outside of the arts or music or whatever, they need some kind of, if you have no idea, you need some kind of qualifier, like why grades exist. It's like, right, you have to be of this level that someone decided is grade one, this is the standard you have to be at. So I get why they exist, but yeah, for, you know, the valuable thing of going to music college is like meeting the people, getting the experience, and being given that it's the only time in your life you're going to get 6 hours a day to practice or whatever, you know.
Yeah, like that's it.
Yeah. Okay, so then what?
So I finished the course and then carried on to working in the local drum shop, and I was working there sort of 5 days a week. Worked really well with the guy, you know, he would be upstairs doing the paperwork, I'd be downstairs meeting and greeting, doing my usual thing of cups of tea for everyone. And, you know, it's my principle on life, whether it's having someone come in and do some work on your house or whether it's someone coming in to buy a drum kit, the first thing you offer them is a beverage.
We can I don't care
who it is. Yeah, well, that's, you know, there's always tea, cake, coffee, you know.
There is.
But
it's brilliant. It's a big part of the reason we turn up, the cake.
I'll have to tell Max that, yeah.
Drum kits first.
Cake second. Well, close second.
So yeah. Do you think that job in that shop is a big part of the reason you run a shop now?
It was a massive grounding. I mean, I look at guys that I talk to on a regular basis that are head of artist liaison for the big manufacturers in the UK that are, you know, working in the big distribution companies that I'm on first name terms with, that I can talk to, I can ring up anytime. And it's from those years of working in the drum shop. Mm. Especially being around the Milton Keynes area, you've got like the Korg, so you've got Paiste, Mapex, Vic Firth, you've got Yamaha, and it was Yamaha and Zildjian at the time. So you've got these guys that were on your doorstep that you build up relationships with. Even guys like Richard Newby that does all my repair work.
Yeah.
He came in the shop a few times working for Yamaha, picking up heads, doing stuff like that. And that's how we first met. That's how when I started getting in contact with him when he was doing what he was doing. So like, "Hi, Richard, do you remember me?" And you know, it's I built up a massive bank of contacts from there. Not sense. Customers particularly, but certainly contacts in the industry.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
You know, before you worked in the drum shop, were you particularly, for want of a better word, nerdy about drums and vintage drums? Or did working in the shop kind of make you more aware of equipment and those kind of things? Because obviously now you're very, very knowledgeable, and that doesn't come, you know, that's got to come from somewhere.
I think I've had a bit of an obsessive, you know, as a kid, into collecting classic car models and stuff like that. Yeah. So you start to, you build up an interest, you build up information and facts on these sort of things. And I think my mind's always worked that way.
Yeah.
But I think it was more, one of my drum teachers said that I was always kind of really into the gear and really interested in what was what. And, you know, you knew about the latest cymbal lines and stuff like that. And one of my other ones, bless him, always said that I should have got a job in a pub. So I think I basically combined those two things. So
the beverages and the drums.
Yeah, beverages and drums. That's it. A bit of hospitality.
Yeah.
And I think from the age of 16, I worked in pubs and worked in that side of things. So you learn how to talk to people and you enjoy interaction with people, which is a massive part of it. If you are an intolerant person, if you don't have a lot of patience, which I am, but I hide it so well. But, you know, I remember going to a show with someone and they said, well, you know, you can talk to anyone. And it's like, well, we've all got something in common. As any musician walking into a music shop is interested in music. We've all got a grounding of the same thing. We all love music. It's always a passion for all of us. So, you know, you hook onto those things. There's been occasions where there've been customers in and I've drawn a blank as to what to talk to them about, or they just don't want to talk. You know, you get those sort of guys. But most of the time, you just want to chat. And I got the best job in the world. I'd sit, drink coffee, surrounded by cool drums, talking to cool drummers. It's, you know.
Definitely. And you've got an amazing new space now, but we'll get onto that as we get.
Yes.
If as much as we can, what I'd like to try and do here is, like, if we can kind of split, could we talk about what else you did on your playing side? I know life doesn't split down like this, but what you did on your playing and teaching side, I guess, and then going, and then split to what happened to the starting the shop, basically.
Well, there isn't really much, but the teaching side of things and the playing side of things kind of just follows the same pattern. So after the ABBA tribute thing, you know, carried on doing function bands, played with a few different bands, did a couple of Elvis tribute shows, and kind of did that whole thing of trying to be a professional musician without any of the big breaks. So you're out on a Thursday night doing a function, and a Friday night, and most weekends. And
well, that's what most of us do, isn't it? That's what the reality is. Yeah. Professional musicians.
And the beauty was, working in a drum shop, there wasn't the pressure of having to get up on a Monday morning and being in a high pressure job where you had to do things. You could turn up and be a little bit tired and a little bit kind of worse for wear from the weekend's gigs, but still get through the first couple of days of selling drums and drinking coffee. So it kind of, having a job like that took the pressure off of the weekend gigs. So I remember stages where you'd leave the shop at 3-4 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon, or sorry, on a Friday afternoon, to go and do a wedding gig in Suffolk, to then drive home to do one in Norfolk the next night, and then there'd be a Sunday jam somewhere that you wanted to go to. And you know, they're trying to do that side of things, trying to do that playing side of things, and balance as much of that as possible. So the drum shop, you know, it gave me some great connections on that side of things, but allowed me to be out and playing and busy with that side as well.
Yeah.
And I became one of these sort of serial deppies, because you met a lot of guys, a lot of drummers in the shop that's like, oh, you know, he was a really nice guy. I'll get him to cover the gig. He seems to know what he's talking about. And ended up depping on some, you know, some very strange gigs, some quite fantastic ones. I remember turning up for a Capita Christmas ball in one of the big London hotels, and the bass player's sitting up next to me, and we're chatting away, and it's a guy called Si Mulvey. He amazing bass player, did some stuff with the Bay City Rollers recently. He used to write for one of the bassist magazines. Chat. And I said, oh, who do you normally play with? He goes, oh yeah, I'm in a band with Thomas Lang. At which point you think, oh, I should just pack the drums up now and go home. It's like, there's nothing you can do to compete with someone that's playing with that sort of thing. But we went on and played your typical function set, and we both had a big smile on our face, both enjoyed doing things. And at the end of it, it's like, oh, that's a great gig. That was really good fun.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's you kind of step into some bigger shoes and you do the best you can with it. I remember doing an Elvis tribute gig down in a Warner Village in, I want to say, Lowestoft, right down on the coast. And it was the days where they posted the CDs out to you to learn the songs before you got to the gig. And I drove all the way down there listening to these songs, and then realized when I got there, I hadn't listened to the drum parts, and I was singing along with the tracks because Dad used to love Elvis and I used to listen to Elvis all the time. So you set up for the gig and you meet the rest of the band and you have a chat and you play through a couple of bits. But the funniest thing with that gig was, I turned up and before I grew the beard, I used to have a big pair of sideburns. I used to shave down here, just have a massive pair of sideburns. Turned up for the gig, and I said to the receptionist at the hotel, I said, I'm here for the Elvis tribute thing. And she laughed at me, and I went, well, I'm sorry, everyone's got to make a living. She went, no, it's all right, it's a convention weekend. We've got Chinese Elvises. We've got Indian Elvises. We've got all sorts of Elvises because you're the first ginger one to turn up, assuming that because of the sideburns, I was going to be an Elvis impersonator. But that was a kind of real seat of your pants moment because I realised I hadn't learned any of the songs. And then it was whatever anniversary it was of his death. And so there's all these diehard fans in their T-shirts, some of them in jumpsuits and rhinestones and stuff like this. And I'm sitting there going, I don't know half these tracks. I'm going to play this gig, bum clenched the whole time. But yeah. The bass player turned after the first set and he said, that's the first time I've done one of these gigs and guys are up dancing.
Yeah,
he said, normally they just sit and watch and they're singing along and tapping along at the side of the stage. But he said, guys got up and danced and it was fantastic. And you think, well, you know, despite your best efforts to learn these things, it's always up to the crowd as well, isn't it? It's up to them if they're going to enjoy themselves.
Definitely. Yeah. Did you do any originals bands or anything then?
Did a couple of bits and pieces like that, but nothing that ever really came to anything. It was all I did one of them from the I joined a band at the age of sort of 17 that were progressive rock, which is a bizarre thing for me. Double bass drum, big extended solo, 7-8 minute long songs, but they played some half decent venues. We did a Bedford Esquires a couple of times with them, but that just all fizzled out in the end. It was a lot of commitment rehearsing every week for nothing. There was a typical band account that the money went into for gigs and replaced guitars and guitar amps, but never any drum bits.
So did you ever do any jazz stuff? You're talking about being into bop and hard jazz, basically. Did you ever pursue any playing in that?
There wasn't particularly a lot of playing around here. So bless him, Roy Holiday kept the only decent big band gig till he was 85. And it's one of those things I always said to him. I said, if you ever retire, a band called Swing's a Thing. And they're still going now. So if you ever retire, Roy, I'd love to do it. I'd really love to do it. And because he didn't retire. Stubborn little bugger that he is.
Yeah, I want to get him in on a podcast. He's
He'd absolutely love it. The stories he could tell you. I mean, I occasionally do that big band now as a depth drummer. I'll sit in when the guy that took it over, when he can't do it, I'll go in and sit and play through it and read through some of the charts just to try and keep my hand in. But
yeah,
very rarely play any jazz at all now.
Do you miss that or is it... or?
Do you know, I was chatting to someone about this the other day, and when I started the shop coming up for 12 years ago, you used to get these professional guys come in and play, and you'd think, you know, I could do that. I'm just as good as them. I could do all that stuff they're doing. And you're kind of not resentful, but it's like, if I'd have been in the right place at the right time, I would have got that gig. And I look now, especially the last few weeks, I've been down on some big recording sessions with a couple of my customers helping and teching and doing that side of things. And you look and you go, I haven't got any of the ability they've got. I'm so busy doing VAT returns and school runs and polishing up drums and teaching that the playing side of things has slipped massively. And I as I said before, I'm not one of these guys that I would sit for hours and hours and hours obsessing and practicing. And to my detriment now, I've got a natural ability, and you know, you'll sit and play a function gig and no one will know anything's gone wrong or anything's out of time or you didn't know a track. But not to the, I used to, you know, pop into the Ronnie Scott's jam nights and stuff like that when I was at Trinity. I wouldn't even dream of going down there now.
Yeah.
But I think there's also a level that, you know, I've got a couple of students that I teach that I think, if I was honest, they could play circles around me on certain things. Not necessarily got the musical experience and the years under their belt, but chops and that side of things, they would absolutely blow me out of the water.
There's a place for all of this, isn't it? Because there's like there's levels that you work at. Like you need to. I hate the phrase good enough, but like you move within your own kind of bands. Like if you sometimes certain circumstances stop you going to that next band, so you're content at the top of the band you're in. You know, like it's
as a lovely drummer Pete Marshall says, he's the best at his pay grade.
Yeah, well, that's a great and there's nothing wrong with that, is it?
Definitely not. No,
like you know. Everyone, we're not all. Thomas Lyon is a very good example. He's amazing, but I shouldn't say this either. But I think he's a bit of a robot as well. He's like a very he can do so many things, but like what are the things in his life have he sacrificed? I don't know. I'm probably saying that out of place because I don't know his personal life. But
I think you're right. I think there are guys that get to that point where it's so technical that there is nothing else there. And I'm not saying that he's one of those because you listen to him on the Will Young stuff that he did, the pop gigs that he did, and it's absolutely faultless.
Yeah, he did the early Spice Girls stuff as well.
Yeah. So you listen to that and you go, absolutely, yeah, absolutely flawless. It's got feel, it's got groove.
And
it's
then
great.
He can do buzz rolls with his feet, you know, like it's
I, you know, with the time at ACM, with the time in the drum shop, I sat in on a couple of masterclasses and clinics with him, and it was just overwhelming. The stuff that he could do with his feet is more than I could do with my hands. That multi-pedal, that heel-toe stuff, it's just bonkers.
Unbelievable, isn't it?
But on the other side of that, having done all those sort of drum clinics and, you know, Adrian Erlison and all those sort of guys, I went and did a masterclass with Peter Erskine at Guildhall recently as a guest, taking some drums down from the drum shop side of things. And to watch someone like Pete Erskine play brushes, and then he sat for about 3 minutes just playing coarse notes on a ride cymbal.
Really?
And it's the most anti-clinic thing, but it was the most beautiful thing. And there were 40-odd multi-instrumentalists, not just drummers, in this masterclass that were just silent in awe of him playing.
Yeah.
And it's that's the side of things. It's, you know, I mean, and Erskine, he was cutting edge. He was on the, you know, right on the cusp of it. He was a million notes all over the place. And he says, you know, that's not now. That's not what I am anymore. I play time and I play feel and I play dynamics. And
yeah,
that's I try and get at least one of those in a gig, either feel, time or dynamics. Anything more than that, I ask for more money.
One per song.
Yeah, that's it.
So to lead in, if we lead into the drum shop then, so did you, when did you start getting interested in vintage drums, and did you kind of want to collect at all? Or like, how did the idea of running a vintage drum shop come about?
So the vintage drum thing, I think it was studying jazz. I think it was the whole thing of being down at Trinity, studying jazz, listening to these guys, you know, listening to Max Roach's records on Gretsch Round Badges. That's where the passion for that side of things came. And working in the drum shop, there was a...
Like the sound of the drums, you mean by that? Listening to like the sound?
Yeah, the sound of the drums. And, you know, you can try and recreate that stuff on modern drums, but it doesn't work. You need the vintage drums.
Yeah.
You know, you look at the... I had a guy, an English teacher, come up a few years ago, and he said, I'm not a very good drummer. I'm not, you know, I can't play very well. I can't justify buying this kit. And he bought a £3,000 Jazzette kit. He says, but every record I listen to is these drums.
Mm.
And he says, I'm trying to recreate it on a £450 Pearl Forum kit at home, and it's not making the same sound. So I'm going to invest in what I know will make that sound to make me practice and make me play. Mm. And I've always been one of these guys. Roy was a perfect example. I remember he must have been in his early 80s, and he came into the drum shop. He came into the one I used to work in and bought a 15-inch Stag single hammered SH crash cymbal.
Okay.
Because he went around, they had a massive room full of cymbals. He went around and he hit this cymbal. He went, that's lovely, I'm going to buy that. And it was like a 50 quid cymbal at the time. And he came back in a couple of days later. He'd just done a big band gig. And I said, well, how was the gig? He went, it's the best I've ever played. I said, oh, really? Was it that good? He goes, that crash cymbal just inspired me. And I played more fills ended on that crash and more stuff using that crash than I've ever done before. And he said, it was just the inspiration from having a good instrument can make it. For anyone at any age, I think.
Yeah.
If you've got something you enjoy playing and you enjoy making the sound from, you play differently because of it.
Mm. You speak it, yeah, you're preaching to the converted here.
Yeah.
I could see a rack of guitars that prove that back there.
I've got about, yeah, I mean, personally, I've got about 30-odd guitars within 10 feet of me here. And then we know more than anybody, Jack's drum buying and
the
craziness of it. And it's all good. And like you say, it's inspiring. So,
but also on the other side of things, if you're playing a lot of gigs of a similar sort of thing, if you're buying new instruments, it makes it feel different when you play a gig as well, don't they? Because every guitar you've got will play slightly differently. So you turn up with a different one on the gig and play the same songs, you're going to play them slightly differently or concentrate more on what you're doing.
And this is really true. Now, obviously, you know, we're here to talk about you, but the thing which I find which is really nice, and I don't know if you drummers would sort of have the same kind of experience, but I find writing songs that you just pick up one guitar that you've not played for a couple of months, and because it plays different, because the attack on it is different, the sound of it's different, you come up with things that you come up with normally, and then you've got a new song suddenly. And it's very, very, very inspiring from that point of view. I don't know if drumming is quite the same kind of idea, but maybe
it is. So.
You know that teacher you were talking about, the guy that bought the £3,000 Jazzette, and if you've got an old 40s or 30s, 40s, 50s kit with, you know, with calf skin on, and you will play that and sound different from something with plastic heads and six ply, won't you? Definitely.
Definitely. And I've done it even on function gigs where I've taken, you know, I've got my typical Ludwig not late 90s, early 2000s kit that I used for years and years back to back every weekend. And then every now and then now I'll take a different kit out. So you know, I took a Vista Light out and play completely differently because it's acrylic drums and they're very punchy and you can get a few more notes out.
Then yeah, I took a. Didn't need any mics.
Yeah, then I took the head off the back of the guitarist in front of me. Yeah. Then I took a 70s Camco out with that big thumpy sound to it and played a fraction of the notes. I'd hardly played, if I played a fill, it'd just be doom, doom, because the sound of the drums was so phenomenal. Mm. So you play differently on every instrument, I think.
So was this your kind of way into it then, from working in the drum shop? Was it that you kind of would see a lot of equipment and players? And where did it start? You said, was it your buddy that you started working
so with? This friend of mine, Ed Nixon, he went to ACM, and then when his dad said he had to go and get a trade, he actually ended up going to Florida and working for the church.
Wow.
In a recording studio. So the church that he worked for had a big recording space, and he was over in Jacksonville and he was working for the church out there, and he bought himself a few drums and he was in there recording church music and doing stuff ready for the services on a Sunday. And he kept messaging me because we kept in touch, and it was the wonders of at the start of Facebook. And he's like, oh dude, I've just bought this, it was so cheap, there's so many cool drums out here. And it was I was in a funny situation in that the guy that I was working for in the shop was struggling financially. It got to the point where he owed me 6 months' wages, and I kind of went enough's enough at that point. I was like, I'm going to have to leave because I'm putting my diesel money on a credit card to come to the shop, and you're not paying me my wages to pay my credit card off.
Yeah.
So it got very awkward on that side of things. Not awkward because he did pay me, and I'll give him all credit that he cleared the debt that was owed to me.
What was the guy struggling with? Was it that early days of the internet taking away a lot of business?
Yes. I think from a someone that's run a business, once you get to a point of in success that you're having to do VAT returns and you're having to do all that paperwork, it takes over from the joy of sitting in a shop talking to people. You know, I lose a couple of days every quarter to sitting in front of the laptop going through spreadsheets. And it does drive me nuts because all you're doing is you're working as a revenue collector and you're not getting paid for it. You're working out what you owe the HMRC and what they're going to take off you. And there's no joy in that side of things. I think he struggled with that side of things. It was the start of the big internet presence. And when you're a generic box shifting business, which is, you know, it's a very big statement on my website that I'm not into that. I will not. You can't press a button on my website and buy a drum kit. You have to get in contact. There has to be that conversation about condition. There has to be some commitment. Interaction with people, some commitment to it. You can't just press a button and it turns up, because that's not the sort of business I want to have. And yes, you have to have a massive social media and website presence, but I'm not selling those middle of the road, turns up in a box, mum and dad set it up as a surprise kits. I'm selling bespoke pieces of history. That's kind of what it is with that side of things.
So it sounds like then that you learned a lot of lessons from this other business.
Definitely. And the other side of it is, guys, there was another chap that I knew really well, lived locally, a guy called Ralph Elmore, who sadly passed away about a year ago, I think. He was massively into the vintage stuff, and he'd bring kits in and we'd try and sell them on behalf. You'd see, you know, someone would bring in an old 400, and because there weren't that many in the UK, you knew who it belonged to before, how much they'd paid for it, any modifications that had been done. So I thought, wouldn't it be a cool thing to start bringing some fresh stuff in? And so it's a weird situation. I was trying to gig as much as possible, working for someone that the money wasn't there, doing a bit of teaching. And I kind of struggled a bit, not, you know, a little bit of the mental health side of things, that I was pushing to be a professional musician, doing jam nights, going out and doing all these kind of tribute gigs and theatre gigs and not getting anywhere. My mum said, look, I think you're struggling. I think you need something else. You need a release. She goes, what do you want to do? And I'd always, you know, one of these things, and we've talked about this before, and I've still got my first car. You know, I was 20 and I bought a 40-year-old Morris Minor and did it up with my dad and my uncle. Cool, yeah. And I had two or three since then. She said, what do you want to do? I said, I fancy an old American car. I fancy getting into nuts and bolts and scraped knuckles and doing something like that. So I went out on eBay and found a 69 Mustang. I was actually looking for a 50s pickup truck, but this 69 Mustang just spoke to me, and my mum lent me the money to buy it. And then I started restoring it. And it was this weird situation that I started restoring it, found a specialist place about 40 minutes from my front door, that were bringing in car parts, bringing in car shells, shipping loads of stuff out of Orlando in Florida in containers. So obviously you're there restoring the car, hemorrhaging money. It spent a lot of time there when they were helping me put it back together, putting parts on it. Got very friendly with the owner. I said, where do you keep bringing these bits in? And he said, well, they're all coming in from Orlando. We ship a container from there. I was like, oh, why? I said, well, I've got a friend in Jacksonville that keeps saying about getting some drums over. I wonder if we could do something. He goes, well, yeah, just stick a few boxes in the container and see what happens. He let me put some in. He charged me a little bit of money for bringing them in. And I think we kind of, very tentatively, I took some money because, you know, I was still at the point where the guy owed me for the drum shop work. So, you know, it was a little bit of a credit card thing. But I had a couple of £1,000 set aside for some paint work on the car. And I sent that over, wired it over to Ed, and he sent over 6 kits. And, you know, there were a couple of from his mates in the area, a couple of early Craigslist adverts and stuff like that. And the guy that gave me the ABBA tribute gig that used to come in the shop, he helped me set up a Facebook page. He kind of helped set up a very basic website on his Apple ID. And that's how Rusty Drums was born. He said, what are you going to call it? I said, well, you know, being Ginger.
That's what I was about to ask. Yeah,
dealing with old drums, let's just call it Rusty Drums. And he looked at me like it was a bit of a crazy thing to do. It's like, I've never been one of these guys that it has to be my name. I've never played drums or done anything to have my name plastered across it. And, you know, I'd feel really awkward driving my van around with Mark Jeff's Drum Emporium on the side of it. It's not what it's about. It was very much a kind of tongue-in-cheek thing. But we started the Facebook page, kind of put photos of the kits up as they landed. And I think 4 of them sold before they'd kind of been here a week.
Wow.
And it was all kind of interesting.
Yeah, and it was all kind of players' condition stuff. I mean, the guy that plays with the big band that Roy used to do now, he used to come in the drum shop occasionally. He used to buy stuff in there. And he said to me, I'm looking for something different. I'm looking for a little 18, 12, 14. I fancy something like that. And I said, well, between you and me, I'm leaving here. I'm starting my own thing. I'm going to do my own thing. I'm going to bring in vintage stuff. Well, let me know when you do it. And he, you know, very proudly, he bought the first kit from Rusty Drums. Cool. Subsequently, he's had about another 7 and probably about 20 snare drums and a lot of cymbals, which we'll joke about at some point. But he bought the first kit, and I've still got the photo of him in the studio when there were 5 kits in there with this Red Sparkle Slingerland that had the rail mount moved from one side to the other. It was about a £900 kit, but that was the first kit to go out. And then he had a matching snare drum to it. And then 7.5 years later, I'm founding the matching 14-inch floor tom to finally go with that kit and complete it. But you know, you start building those relationships. And I remember my mum saying, she goes, it's a really great idea. It's a really nice thing that you're doing. What happens when you run out of friends to sell drums to? I said, well, you have to make new friends, don't you? But the way I've never done any pay clicked adverts, anything like that. It's all been very organic. It's all been word of mouth. It's all been just putting the stuff out there. You know, I'm very much, and I know it annoys the hell out of a lot of people, my Facebook page and my Instagram page, I do not put prices on. I don't sell things through those platforms. There's a website where there's, you know, with the drum kit, there's usually 120 photos of every mark, scratch, knock on it. But I do not force things down people's throat. I'll post something up most days of the week, and you know, this has just hit the website, that's just hit the website, and there's always a link there to click on it. But I don't feel that I need to force prices. If you're interested in something, you'll then follow the link or you'll ask the question. But I've never felt that I need to kind of ram it down people's throats with that side of things.
I think that probably weeds out the tire kickers to a degree. I think if people want it and they've got the money, they'll come for it.
Yeah, that's it.
That's straightforward.
But something that I've noticed that I feel like you've done differently to other drum shops I know or people who are dealing drums and stuff is I kind of feel, maybe this is wrong, but you went in at kind of higher end drums at a start. Like from importing drums from America, they're more, you know, you're not dealing in lower British end premier stuff or Olympic stuff, which nothing wrong with. It's how a lot of people start and you build up. So doesn't sound like that was a conscious decision particularly, though. It's just what you had access to.
Yeah, it's a series of unfortunate accidents that just ended up on the right path. That I listened to guys playing round badges and guys playing old Ludwig kits, and that's what I wanted to bring in. And having, you know, one of my best friends move to Jacksonville and have this stuff at his feet, it just made it the right choice to make. And we did, you know, we started off bringing in players condition kits, so bass drum hoops have been changed, or you know, satin flames where the wraps all hanging off the drums, or you know, that sort of stuff. But it's slowly built, and as you do it, and you know, I spent, as you know, it was all in my home studio. I spent about the first 5 or 6 years for the business just putting all the money back in.
Yeah. Because
I was teaching still, and it was very much as the fashionable words are, side hustle, but very much a hobby thing, just to keep me from being bored. And there's the excitement of the chase. It's the same with, you know, every stupid car that I've ever bought. It's the excitement of seeing something and wanting it, and then getting it there, and I still get that today. But the
thrill of the chase and getting the thing, like, I'm sure me and Martin can attest to that. But we normally keep the stuff that we buy. Whereas how do you deal with getting it and then selling it on then?
When it sells, it affords the next one, doesn't it? And that's the way to look at it. And the amount of people that said, oh, why don't you keep one of those? Why don't you keep one of those? For the level of gigs that I do, there is no point. I can dip my toes. I can take something off the shelf and try it and actually play it and give people an honest appraisal of how well it played Summer of 69 and Brown Eye Girl at the Dog and Duck on a Thursday night. And if I was recording, I would keep an old Radio King or an old Leedy with some calf heads on. But for what I do as a what is now a dad rock band, I guess, Radio 2 Dad Rock, there is no point in keeping these beautiful drums. And I own them. You know, it's an interesting thing, because I always say I don't own them. They are in my possession until they sell, and I get the joy of having them there. But knowing they're going off to the right person for the right gig afterwards, it's much more exciting, and it means that I can then afford to find the next one and chase the next one.
Yeah. Well, you provide an amazing service for like people like me, because you just you don't go many places that have that great selection of stuff. It's just great quality and all in the same space, you know.
And that was the big thing for me. It was that thing of, okay, yeah, it's cool to have a 400 on the shelf. Isn't it cooler to have half a dozen that someone can choose from? Because maybe the super shiny, really expensive one doesn't sound as good as the one that's pitted and played for the last 40 years and, you know, really kind of honed in.
Exactly.
So it was always that thing of having a big choice. And after we did that first shipment, I remember going to the National Drum Fair up in Birmingham, you know, the old vintage drum show that it used to be. And unfortunately, my container, I took out a credit card, and I took a £6,000 credit card, transferred the money over to it, and we bought 45, 50 snare drums, a load more kits, and the container missed the deadline from about a week. So I took this coming soon list, and weirdly, I took this flyer and showed people what was coming soon. And I had half a dozen snares and a few bits for the show. And this year at the Coventry show, a guy called Mike stood on the booth next to me and he said, look at this. And he pulled out that flyer. And every year he wrote down the year and, you know, interesting kits that I'd bought and all these bits and pieces for every year of the show. And this year asked me to sign it and say best wishes and all this sort of stuff. He goes, I always kept your business card. I said, I don't do business cards. I never have done. He goes, no, I've got this. And he opened up this A5 flyer with this coming soon list of stuff on it. And it was just quite a surreal thing to go back and see that, really.
So did the kind of business just grow from that then? He managed to invest more money and then get higher quality kits, essentially, then?
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. And the more guys that came and bought stuff, the more stuff we could afford to do. And it got to the point, as you saw with my setup here at home, that there were 35, 40 kits and about 200 snare drums in the smallest space possible, and then a garage full of drums and a carport with shelves over cars and
yeah it needs more describing everywhere. Than that to the listeners. It was like an alleyway between drums stacked from ceiling, you know, floor to ceiling, like on top of each other, and, you know, Ludwigs and Slinglers quality stuff with this alleyway that just fits enough, but, you know, sometimes going sideways, fitting through.
Yeah, having to shuffle sideways through the room. Yeah.
and then you open your garage where your Mustang and your Morris Minor are still there with drums all over the room. And it was like, yeah, you desperately needed the new place, which you moved into 2 years ago, was it?
That was just a strange conversation that I had. I had Freddie Sheed, who's a dear friend and a customer for a long time, and
yeah, amazing,
we worked together a lot. Amazing drummer, absolute gentleman as well. He came up with a friend of his called John Gilmore, who's a producer and drum enthusiast, works with the 1975s and a lot with the Dirty Hits label. And at John's first trip up here, you know, obviously walk in the house, there's cake, there's coffee, there's Trudy wanting affection and attention, the dog Trudy is, for anyone who doesn't know. And he came in and he said, well, you know, I go into all these big studios across London and they've all got your website up. You've got such a reputation, such a great following. And he says, and I don't mean to be rude, as lovely as your home setup is, it doesn't match with the persona that your business has got professionally. He said, have you ever thought about premises? And I said, well, I have. But, you know, the idea of buying somewhere or renting somewhere and then having to put my prices up is what I saw as a pitfall for the guy that I used to work for and so many drum shops in the last 20 odd years. But having that physical presence suddenly costs you more money to turn the heating on, turn the lights on.
Yeah, at the time that the brick and mortar model is like falling away, you're having to look at brick and mortar shop, as it were.
Going the other way with it, yeah, and kind of going completely against the trend. And then in that conversation, Freddie Turner said, well, if you had somewhere, it would take the pressure off my bed frame that every time I bought a snare drum, I wouldn't be trying to tuck it under the bed before my fiance saw it in my one bedroom flat in Finsbury Park.
Mm.
You know, he was buying beautiful drums and then leaving them in friends' studios because he had nowhere to store them. Yeah. So he said, if you build a shop that you put some storage rooms into, I will rent a storage space off you. And suddenly there's half a dozen guys wanting to do that. And you go, well, this is a different platform. This is a different way of doing things that I can provide.
They'll pay you rent.
Guys, they will cover a large proportion of the rent. And I have a bigger shop space, more purpose built, out of the way, not annoying the neighbours.
Yeah.
And it's not costing me. I'm not having to add £100 markup on every snare drum that I sell to cover it.
And it's beautiful as well. Like everything you do, it's a really nice space to be in. You know,
happy accidents. I you know, it's better as my chippy friend who did it with me said, and it's always going to stick with me. It's better to be lucky than good.
Yeah.
Ooh, that's nice. Can I just add that on this subject of your website being up and stuff, like, I'm not a drummer, but even I get kind of very interested in your Instagram and your website and stuff. I just think there's such beautiful, obviously, like, high quality things on there. It even works on me, and I don't even play bloody drums. It's beautiful.
They are, you know, they are beautiful pieces of art, aren't they?
Functional.
You take a decent photo of a drum kit and it's a nice sparkle or it's a nice wood grain finish, it's going to draw the eye. They're a beautiful thing.
They are.
Especially when you go back to the old 40s Art Deco stuff and that kind of thing. It encapsulates an era.
It does. And I just think that, you know, even I, that as a, I've, anything I know about drums, I've learned from talking to Jack for, you know, hours on the M1 at 2 a.m, which is fine because he knows about resonator guitars now. But
that's a fair trade off. I like that.
Yeah, it's fine. We both bore each other and it's fine, but it passes the time, so it's good. But he's nodding. But no, what is it? It's the quality that I kind of really can see, even though I don't really know so much and appreciate. It's the quality and the high end degree that you've got the best examples of. The best kind of things.
So I am really lucky. So my business partner Ed, he ended up, he was working in Jacksonville. He got an audition with Berkeley because Berkeley will travel around the country doing auditions, and he thought, well, I never finished my degree at ACM. I did my diploma and higher diploma. I'm going to see if I can get a bit of paper. He auditioned and got a place at Berkeley to study performance and production, which is
yikes,
quite prestigious. You know, you either usually do one or the other, and he ended up doing both. And decided to move up to Boston. In the meantime, met a girl that later became his wife, and that, you know, they were living up in Boston. He did his course, and he said at the end of his course, he goes, look, we're thinking, she's from New Zealand, we're thinking about moving to Australia. I was like, oh, right, okay, crikey. And in the meantime, you know, the business had kept growing. We'd taken on some lines. I was working with the guys at CNC Drums and doing a lot of work with them, working as their artist liaison in the UK and retailing the drums, sole retailer for the drums as well. And I decided that, knowing that the writing was on the wall with Ed, I thought, I'll travel out to Boston. I'll go and see him, spend some time with him in Boston. His fiance had already flown out to New Zealand at this point. So there was just the two of us having a kind of a week with the lads, hanging out, checking out some cool drum shops up on the North Shore and up that way. But I flew down to Kansas and went down to CNC and met those guys as well. Because, you know, I always feel that even after a couple of years working with them, actually meeting face to face is so much better than video calls and you know, and WhatsApp messages here and there. So I went down there, and David Conroe, who was looking after the non-American accounts, he looked after CNC Europe and he looked after myself and Australia. He put me up for the night, and we went out and went to an amazing barbecue joint, and then we went to a dive bar and had a couple of drinks there. And the next day we were chatting on the way into CNC, and he said, oh, you know, I'd love what you do as you know, I'd love a side hustle, you know, that trendy term again. I'd love a side hustle like that, getting involved with what you do. I think it's amazing. I said, well, strangely enough, and you know, this whole thing of being lucky. So strangely enough, Ed's going to bow out of it. He's not going to continue doing it. So I'm actually looking for someone that's going to take over that buying side of things. I said, it's kind of cool. You buy stuff, I pay for it. And when I sell it in the UK, you get half the profit from it. Mm. It's a no-brainer for me, isn't it? You know, if I get to, I'm working in a drum manufacturing company. I also get to sniff out all the old drums, all the vintage stuff, buy it with someone else's money and make money from doing it. So that's how David became involved. And then I'm very lucky in that he's got a great team of guys that he works with, a great bunch of friends that he works with across the States, guys like Joey from Wood and Weather Drums and yeah. Chris from Hawthorne Drums and Jose at Revival. And probably more guys than, you know, Scott from Tackle, who's got his own store as well. And these guys, we've got this fantastic network that we just get in touch with each other. It's like, dude, before I stick it on Reverb, which is a whole different story for me, I've got this kit. Are you interested in this? Do you fancy these two? Do you want these before I list them? And, you know, I get to cherry pick these drums and you know, we still scour Craigslist adverts and do all that sort of stuff. But there's this just network of guys that have great stuff that are willing to trade and do this sort of thing.
Am I right in thinking you send out some British drums as well?
Yeah, David. So David runs, he left CNC and he runs his own company called the Standard Drum Company. So he makes some amazing drums for himself and for he sells a lot through Nelson's, who I should have mentioned in the network of amazing drum shops.
Yeah,
as well.
I bought a couple of bits off of, we visited yeah. the shop, Martin.
We called in there. That's Nashville, isn't it?
Yeah. That is Nashville, yeah. So Bryson Nelson, he's an absolute sweetheart of a guy.
Yeah.
We went in the week and they were just like packing, I think Wednesday or Thursday, and they were just packing up in boxes to go to the Chicago show where we went, obviously.
Yeah.
And saw you there.
So David sells his drums through those guys, through Wooden Weather, through all those guys, and he does that side of things. He's had a few Heyman kits and bits and pieces. I've actually got a couple of British kits to send him at the minute. I've got a Heyman and a Ajax and a couple of Ajax kits that I'm going to ship out to him that he takes to the Chicago show and sells there and puts on his website as well.
Can I ask a question as a non-drummer, which
yeah.
Jack's told me, and I just now I get to sort of straighten it. You know how you're kind of taking over British kits and then you're bringing back American kits?
Yeah.
This is a silly question probably to you guys, but is the quality and the sound the same or similar, of a similar standing?
I would say that in some cases, some of the British stuff was better made than the American stuff.
Okay.
But and we've got this home market apathy. I grew up in a school where they had a knackered old Premier kit where the legs fell off and the tom holder didn't work and it had crappy heads that hadn't never been changed. So whenever I see a Premier kit, I think, well, it's just an old Premier. It's just a beaten up old kit. And you kind of get that thing. And Roy always said it, you know, after the Second World War, anything that could be imported from America was amazing. And you know, you aspired to owning it. And I think there's still a big psychological thing for that now.
Like 60 or 61, where there was just a massive trade ban on American goods. It was about early 60s, yeah. I think. And so to get American stuff was really difficult then. It literally is, the grass is always greener. It just seems exotic. It's that simple.
It is. I mean, it's one of those things that you listen to all those old American records, all those famous records, and they are recorded on those drums.
Yeah.
They didn't sneak a Premier kit into the studio. It is all the old American Ludwigs and Slinglands and Gretches. But it's that thing, isn't it?
It's as well, isn't it? But I mostly agree with Mark, yeah.
And, you know, I'm the same with my cars. I've just bought a stupid Dodge because it's cool to have a Dodge. I could have bought a Range Rover. I could have bought something like that. But I want something a little bit different. I want to turn up and be that quirky guy in the American car because it ties in with everything that I do.
I just love the idea as a business that you take a load of British drums, box them up, ship them to America, and then a load of American drums come the other way. What a
crazy,
great business. And what I love the idea is it literally the case then that, like, when, say, an American session drummer or drum collector turns up at the studio with his drum kit and he's got a British drum kit, it just means he's really cool and different? Is it that simple?
I think it is that. I mean, we had some really big success with Heyman drums, sending them out to the States, because they were never released in America. They were a London-based brand that were there to combat the American influx. So in the mid-60s, or late 50s, or early 60s, they went, right, we need to build some drums that replicate this sound and do this. And, you know, you look at them, they're no way near as well-built as the American stuff. But they've got a certain sound to them. And if if you're a drum collector, if you like in the world of guitars, if you've got half a dozen kits and you've got a nice Ludwig example and you've got a nice Gretsch example, and you've got your Rodgers kit, suddenly this quirky English thing turns up that kind of replicates it and kind of looks a bit like it, and isn't as much money as the American stuff, you're going to go, well, yeah, I'll have a little punt. I'll have one of those just to have just to have it in my collection, have a rattle around on it. It will sound different. It will feel different to play. Why not?
Sure.
We're going to start to wrap this up soon, Mark, but I wanted to ask, we've got four little silly questions we ask at the end of every. Before I get onto that, I just wanted to ask, are there any kits that, you know, that really stood out to you, been really proud to have had through the doors?
I've been lucky. I've had some really incredible stuff. I've got an amazing late 40s Leedy kit at the minute, which is a beautiful example. I had a 49 round badge that we bought from the original owner. David was on his way down to the Chicago show, and I've got pictures, and that was a beautiful kit to have. That was a, you know, the old Art Deco rocket lug 24, 13, 16 with the matching snare. You know, I've been very lucky. There've been some very special kits. And then, you know, when I moved into the shop, I bought that Leedy knob tune kit, and it's something different. It probably will never sell, but it's such a quirky kit to have because, you know, it encapsulates that little period of time.
Yeah.
And it's sitting there with all its original calf heads on.
Yeah, proper kind of timepiece.
Yeah. So someone might have it for a museum, for a collection. It's a perfectly playable kit. If it sits on the shelf forever, and maybe I'll take it out and abuse it on a function gig somewhere.
And any others? Any other that stand out to you? Any snare drums or anything?
Yeah, but I mean, there's been some really sort of special stuff. I had a Peacock Sparkle Camco orchestral model. You know, it's these things that where, having had so many drums through my hands and seen so many drums, you sometimes get frustrated with the book smart people that have read the catalogues and seen those sort of things, and that's all they know. And, you know, you pull out something in a finish that was never catalogued. Mm. I had one recently, a couple of years ago, I bought a charcoal satin flame Slingland kit. And I didn't, it wasn't a top end money. It wasn't one of these big collector's kits. But Simon Wagstaff, that runs the Coventry show, that obviously collects these kits, couldn't believe that I got this uncatalogued finish.
Wow. Yeah.
You know, it's one of these things. It's going to be an ultra rare thing because they didn't catalogue it. It was a custom order or something they did as a, you know, just to try the wrap out. And there was one standing in front of him that he could have. So those things are kind of cool. I've got a Gretsch DRB snare drum at the minute, which is, if you know your Keith Moon stories and that side of things, they were made specifically for Keith Moon. So it looks like a communal garden wooden Gretsch snare drum, but it's got a little metal plaque on the side that says DRB, which stands for Dirty Rotten Bastard. And inside on the paper tag is written in handwritten in ink, special, which you only ever see that writing on 16-inch bass drums from that era and stuff like that. And there were so few of them made, and I've got one sitting in the shop. And it will, you know, again, it's one of those things that, oh, you could write your own price tag. Yeah, that, you know, with those sort of things, there are a finite number of them. And if it's obsessive, then maybe that's something you'd want. But for most drummers, it's just a cool thing to see. Mm. And it's nice to have those things without turning the shop into a museum.
Can I ask then about this DRB? So if that was made for, like, for Keith Moon, would that have been something that was made and shipped to him and he had, or it just never reached him, it's just been floating around?
I don't know the background of it. I bought it from a guy that I used to deal with a lot in Florida, and it was part of a kit that he had, and it's they were all like a walnut lacquer finish, and this one's obviously weathered and obviously seen better days on the finish side of things. It, you know, most of the lacquer's flaked off it, but they were only made for him. So whether it was something that was, it might have been left somewhere with a tech somewhere in the States on tour. You know, there's pictures of Keith Moon playing at the Oval Cricket Ground with one on his kit, playing with cricket bats. So, you know, typically with the stories you hear about Keith Moon, you don't know how many of his drums actually survived. I had the bass player from Martha Rees and the Vandellas come down and ask me to sell a kit on his behalf. Right. I said, well, how have you got this kit? He goes, well, the drummer bought it. We were touring in the early 80s, and it was a 70s jazzette kit. And he said, at the end of the tour, he was just going to throw it in the skip. Oh. I mean, that's a £3,500-£4,000 drum kit that he was going to bin, because at that point, it was just a second-hand drum kit.
It's a used kit, and whatever that costs.
Made your money off the tour, yeah.
Yeah, you've made your money, and it's just this piece of, you know, this piece of junk you've got to carry around. Is there anything in terms of drums and really high-end or collectible or certain specific things that you would love to handle and have for a bit that you've not had yet?
Do you know what? I've been trying to get hold of a duplex Spirit of St. Louis drum since I started doing the business, only because
what's that then? I don't know what that is. Sorry,
Duplex. Duplex were a drum making company, and the Spirit of St. Louis. What was unusual about their drums is their lugs were built internally into the shell. So you look at every drum from the the 20s onwards, all the metalwork's on the outside of the shell. With this, it's very much a smooth finished drum because the metalwork's hidden inside.
Right.
I don't know masses about the company. I've seen a few drums come up. There was one at the Chicago show, I think the year that we were all out there. The 18. Reason I want one is because Roy Holiday has always wanted one. And you know, I've known Roy since I was 13 and I'm now 41 almost. And he's always said about having one and owning one. And I would love to have one just to give it to him to sit on a shelf in his house or to have it on a stand and just stare at for a couple of years. So that'd be something I'd love to have. There are, you know, the things like Rolling Bombers, the old wartime stuff, the stuff where the metal rationing was on. I've got a Rolling Bomber snare in the shop at the minute. I've had some work done by Richard Newby and I'm going to ship back to the customer. And everyone that was in over the weekend was like, oh my God, you've got one. It's like, it's not mine, but I would love to have one.
Are these what you want, Jack? Yeah, I fancy a victory kit. The Ludwig one was a victory, wasn't it? Roland Bomber was the...
I've got a Leedy Dreadnought snare on the way over, which I posted pictures that David shared the other day, which has caused a lot of fuss. So it's this whole thing of, you know, the wartime period when metal, non-essential metal was rationed to 10%. So the drums all had rosewood lugs or, you know, everything that could be made out of something that wasn't metal was.
Joey, the guy that's got them, hasn't he, out in the States? He's like the worst.
Yeah. Joey Meckler, yeah, he's got a load of stuff out there. I had a Gretsch Defender, which was another one that they made theirs out of wood. Even the consulate rail across the top of the bass drum was made out of bent plies of wood. The lugs were solid wood, but they painted them silver to look like metal.
Yeah.
But it's just, and it was quite crude in that the bass drum lug was a double-ended, quite a long thing. And for the toms, they just literally cut it in half and didn't even bother painting the end that they'd cut. But you think, you know, that it was non-essential at that point.
Yeah. No, I really fancy one. I'd like to. Yeah, I'd like one of every, at least one of every decade. Yeah.
I can help you with that, Jack. I've told you this.
Really? I know, Matt. You're looking for a couple for me. Aren't you?
He's an enabler.
I am. That's what I do.
Yeah, enabler. That's it, definitely.
Okay, then, Matt. Well, thanks so much for doing this. We're just going to ask these four silly questions that we ask every guest, and hopefully this is interesting for people to listen to. And I've really enjoyed hearing the story of where you came from. So, the first one we ask everyone is, knowing what you know now, what advice would you give to your younger self?
I think I'm going to have to go with my chippy friend Jay's words, and it's better to be lucky than good. Perfect. I think, you know, certainly in the music career, if I look back now, it's who you know, isn't it? It's that whole thing of it's the networking side of things more than sitting trying to squirrel away at a degree thinking that someone's going to walk into college and find you there and whisk you off for an audition.
You have to be able to back it up as well, I think, though. It's who you know, but also be able to do the gig, isn't it, as well?
Oh, definitely, yeah. So it's having that balance and not obsessing over one side of of what to try and make it in this business that we call show.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
How would you describe your job to a five-year-old?
How do I explain it to my five-year-old? What do I tell them I do? Yeah. Well, it's a strange one, isn't it? Because I teach drums, I play drums, I sell drums. But to him, Daddy's just got a shop full of drums. He calls it either the shop or the unit, and he comes down and there's just drums everywhere, and that's it. I have a drum shop.
Who would play you in a film of your life?
Wow. I mean, I don't think they could scrape a film together from my life, to be honest. There's no one unfortunate enough to look like me, is there? Sure.
Bald beard. There's a Bruce Willis with
a beard. It's definitely on trend at the minute, the bald and beard thing, I think. It's the first time I've been fashionable since I had a mullet, I think.
We've seen this next question in action many times when we're on tour and we pop in, but how do you take your tea?
I don't drink tea. I'm a coffee drinker. Well, so when I make my tea, it's very badly for other people.
So how do you have your coffee?
Well, I've had a lot of years making tea for Max, and if the spoon can't stand up in it, she's not interested. But coffee, it's always bean to cup because I'm a bit of a ponce with it. But always a nice, strong flat white or a latte for me.
Not ponce, it's quality, Mark. That's what you are. I think you're
coming for that. That's it. I don't know, when you move into a drum shop and the first things you buy are a £400 sofa and a £500 coffee machine, I think your business model is a little bit kind of sideways, isn't it?
That to me says that you've got your priorities straight.
It's one of these things that I say to people. It's about the hang. It's as much about having people in the shop. It's one of the things, if you've got two or three people in the shop, they're going to talk about drums that you wouldn't even contemplate mentioning to them. someone comes in with a certain sound in mind, I don't know all the answers. So if there's someone else there that can tell him, and all that's cost me is 20p for a cup of coffee, I'm on a winner, aren't I, really?
Well, yeah, well, Mark, thank you so much for this today. I've known you for quite a few years, but as I say, I didn't know your backstory, so it's nice to kind of know how that's all come along. Yeah, so
you'll never look at me the same again, will you?
No, it's great. And I say, I hope this will be useful for other people that want to know, you know, well, friends and business colleagues of you now that might want to know, but also just years in the future. That's what this podcast is about, really. It's just
fantastic
of what this time was like. So thanks so much for giving us your time. And everyone, check out Rusty Drums. Thanks so much, Mark. See you soon.
Pleasure.
Okay, there we go. That was Mark Jeffs. Martin, what are your immediate thoughts on that?
Do you know what? I love, you know, those days when he was working at the house and you'd go and get a piece of homemade cake and I just watch you trying out drums and choosing drums and buying drums. I love that. I always look forward to it. What I didn't know was just how... it sounds like how hard he's worked at trying to kind of find his way in the drum world. And I love how almost like naturally he fell into dealing, and how much his really decent personality and his honesty has allowed him to become this kind of dealer. He's just a decent guy selling decent drums. And it sounds like, you know, it's well deserved. I mean, what do you think?
Well, I didn't know. He's a lovely man, always has been. From the first time I've met him, he's like just very approachable and kind of knows his stuff without showing off, if you will. And he works with some high end people, but he doesn't name drop. And he's like, I already had good feelings from him, and that's why I bought stuff from him. You know, yeah, he's a family guy. He still obviously loves playing and loves teaching, and I feel like I know a bit more of the whole package of him, really. And I feel like he's probably scratched the itch, maybe as he wanted and maybe as we all did, to be that like famous session drummer. Maybe he scratched that itch a bit more by being a very specialist and successful drum dealer, if you will.
Yeah, I think you get that impression, don't you? I think it sounds to me like he's found his happy place. He can go out and play some gigs. He's studied it, he's lived it. And then he obviously loves the equipment. Mm. And it feels like, you know, he gets to go in and probably keep some fairly regular hours and be a family man as well. And he's not all over the place at all hours of the day and the weeks and the months and away for a long time. And you know what? It just seems like everything's really well deserved, you know.
I mean, I think he likes being creating that space for, as you said, like people chatting and learning from other people and stuff as well. And just being able to create that space for people to hang around and talk drums, I think.
I've always like really liked just sort of being in his sort of presence. And I don't know, I just feel like I respect him even more now, you know, having had that conversation and to see what that business was all about. You know, I got this lovely little dream of when I move house soon, of having my own little kind of music studio. I want to have a little drum kit in there. And I just sort of want to go and buy whatever little vintage drum kit I want to buy off him. That's what I feel like, you know.
And if you want to buy off Rusty Drums... then you can find,
him
online, Rusty Drums. So I hope you enjoyed that podcast and we'll see you next week. Goodbye.
Thanks for listening to The Washboard Resonators Present.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe, rate and leave a comment.
And to support our band, please sign up to the mailing list. You'll find the link in the show notes and on the website.